This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Life goes on, and life did go on for the rest of us today, thanks in such large measure to those whose lives do not go on, those who paid the ultimate price, those we remember today. They leave the rest of us to conduct the business of our lives pretty much as usual, but ever mindful that there is always such a heavy cost to being free. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks very much for making us a part of your Memorial Day. We're glad to bring you up to date on this Monday, May 28th, a working Monday for officials from 75 nations meeting in Anchorage on the fate of commercial whaling. There's been a moratorium for more than two decades, but the International Whaling Commission has been leaning in favor of lifting that ban. And as Sam Eaton reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, that puts a bright spotlight on this year's meetings.
Pro-whaling nations don't have enough votes yet to overturn the moratorium on commercial whaling. That would take a three-quarters majority. But the debate is so heated that the International Whaling Commission rarely strays from the subject. Karen Sack with Greenpeace says this year's meeting isn't any different.
It has become a one-issue show where the focus has been on Japan, Iceland, and Norway trying to overturn the moratorium and entrench their interests in commercial whaling.
With a full-scale repeal of the whaling ban unlikely, critics say Japan is resorting to backdoor tactics. This year, Japan is floating a new proposal to allow subsistence hunting in its coastal communities. Japan already harvests around 1,000 whales a year for scientific research, but then sells the meat. That's driving dozens of anti-whaling protests in cities around the world today. But traditional Eskimo whalers on Alaska's North Slope say the commission is failing to address an even bigger threat. For the first time in history, the U.S. is selling the right to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean, the same waters where Koktovik whaler Robert Thompson hunts bowhead.
My concern is, can oil be cleaned up in the Arctic Ocean? And nobody has yet answered that question. They do not have the technology to clean it up.
Thompson says an oil spill in the Arctic's icy waters wouldn't only hurt the bowhead whales that feed there. It would bring an end to an Eskimo tradition that spans thousands of years. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
When you've spent 11 of the past 17 years under on-again, off-again detention, it can't get any easier having your hopes for freedom dashed yet again. Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi will stay under house arrest in Burma. That news over the weekend from the military junta in Burma. They call it Myanmar. The West has imposed economic sanctions in response to the country's treatment of advocates for democracy. Even so, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Shanghai, Burma's government has managed not just to survive, but to thrive.
In the late 1980s, Burma's military cracked down on democracy efforts, and the U.S. and the EU responded with trade sanctions. But they've had little effect. Ian Story of the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies says that's because when the West pulled out, China pulled in.
It has become Burma's number one partner in terms of military equipment, financial support. It's basically thrown the country an economic lifeline.
And ties will likely deepen. Burma has deep natural gas reserves, which Beijing wants.
Going forward, it's likely that Burma will only entrench its position as a vassal state of China economically.
That's Sean Turnell of the Burma Economic Watch. He says sanctions won't choke off Burma, but
many of the leaders of Burma's military regime would really like to send their children to universities in the United States and Europe and so on. So we shouldn't understate, in a sense, the effectiveness of some of those sanctions.
For China, a friendly Burma provides a geographic buffer against a rising India to the west. In short, security. Sun Cheng teaches at the China University of Political Science and Law.
Asian and Western countries have basic differences in how they approach these relationships. China focuses a lot more on security and stability in the region.
As for the renewed house arrest of Burmese democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi, Beijing has remained silent. It considers her detention an internal affair in Burma. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Let's say your car needs new tires or an oil change. You can call the mechanic and find out exactly how much it's going to cost. You could also call his competition down the block and see if it might be cheaper there. But what if you need a hepatitis B vaccination or an EKG? It's pretty much been anybody's guess how much those things might cost. Now, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports, one California doctors group is trying to change that.
At Healthcare Partners Medical Group in Southern California, a hepatitis B vaccine will cost $137. That electrocardiogram? $45. That information and the cost of more than 50 other basic medical services is listed on the company's website. The list is intended to give people more information about the cost of medical care and to let the group compete against walk-in clinics in drugstores and big-box retailers.
The idea of transparency, for some reason, has not really taken off in healthcare until just recently.
Dr. Karen DeSalvo is at Tulane's Medical School. She says having prices out in the open will make things more fair, especially for the uninsured. They often end up paying a lot more for the same procedure. That's because insurance companies can negotiate cheaper group rates, clout that the uninsured can't take advantage of.
Posting the price sort of levels the playing field for everyone.
But Stefan Kertész isn't convinced. He's a physician at the medical school at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He thinks putting a price on procedures takes away from what it is the doctor does.
So most of the time, patients don't shop for individual services. We shop for a person. That person is one who we want to know us. We want them to know our priorities and what kind of person we are. And then we want that person to take the time necessary to advise us on which tests we might actually need and which ones we don't.
The company says it wants to make it easier for patients to figure out their health care budgets now that more people are footing the bill for more of their health care costs. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
U.S. financial markets were closed for the holidays, so we'll have a different kind of price check today, a look at where gasoline prices are now when we do the numbers. Another British city is looking for some fast relief from congestion of the automotive kind. The idea of charging an extra fee in high-traffic areas seems to be catching on over there, and some drivers fear it could be the start of a nationwide system of traffic-based pricing. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from London. Greetings, Stephen.
Hello, Bob.
Seems to me that this gives a whole new meaning to the idea of toll roads here. What's the plan taking hold? Could every road become a toll road someday?
Well, we're talking specifically here about one city in the UK, and we're talking about a trial. This, if it goes ahead, will not be implemented until the year 2012. But the way it would work in Manchester, in the northwest of England, is that an electronic tag would be put inside the windshield of drivers intending to drive into the city. This would be tracked by satellite and or a roadside monitoring device. And the driver would then be charged $4 to go into the outer zone, $2 to go into the inner zone, and then $2 as he leaves each zone. So we could be talking about a total charge of $10 for taking your car in and out of the city of Manchester.
Well, this homing device idea makes me say, whoa, Are there any privacy concerns from tracking all these vehicles?
Well, there is a privacy concern, certainly, but above and beyond that, there's a concern about the cost. The reaction to this Manchester proposal has been pretty hostile. I mean, you've got individuals saying, we work in the centre of the city, we have to take our cars into the centre of the city. This is going to work out pretty expensive. This is a tax, they say, and it's unfair because it's regressive. It hits rich and poor alike. On the other hand, Manchester City Council and some large business organisations in the city say doing nothing is not an option. Congestion has an economic cost.
Economic cost? Are they also selling this as a way to improve the environment?
It is both an economic and an environmental issue. This is one of the main reasons the British government, the central government, is interested in this and has invited cities around the UK to come up with their road pricing proposals, not only to curb congestion in this overcrowded and densely populated country where traffic congestion is a major problem, but also this measure is seen as a way of tackling climate change, of reducing carbon emissions.
I know this idea to charge extra for driving in congested areas started out there in London. There was a lot of grumbling back when it was hatched, as I recall. Are people more accepting now that it's in place, by the way?
Generally speaking, you're right. There was a lot of animosity, a lot of hostility towards it. But it has been in place now since 2003. The congestion charge has gone up. It's now $16 to take your car in into the city and out again. But it has proved pretty effective. It has reduced traffic congestion substantially in central London, and it has raised a lot of money, which has gone into public transport. And the buses and the trains in central London are undoubtedly much better now.
Stephen Beard in London, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Brace yourself, by the way. This idea could be coming to your city. In case you missed it, just last month, New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg proposed a new $8 congestion fee for drivers in parts of Manhattan during peak weekday hours. Is this your day for getting in some swings on the links? There's nothing like a leisurely day of golf. And then there's beyond leisurely. The difference is where you choose to play. Golf's popularity has sent demand for tee times sky high in some smaller countries, and courses can charge a pretty penny. So that's led to some, shall we say, creative alternatives. As Marketplace's Rico Galliano found out a little while back on a trip to the Netherlands. Here's an encore of the story he put together to prove he's a golfer who's outstanding in his field, or at least in somebody else's field.
On a sunny fall day in northeast Holland, Ronald Duursen shows off the golf course he owns and operates.
We are here right at hole 9. There should have been a flag on a post 2 meters above it, but the cows just wrecked the flag post. They broke it.
Seriously, cows broke it. Nearby, the turf is getting mowed, or rather eaten. By a cow. My friend Ken points across the green at another one.
A water hazard, that would be in golf language.
The cow is peeing.
Yeah, a yellow water hazard.
Every year, tens of thousands of people in 5 European countries pay about $8 apiece to play golf on courses like this. Well, not exactly golf, but a new, very Dutch variant called boerengolf, a.k.a. farmer's golf.
Hello.
Hello.
Cheesemaker Peter Weinig invented the game 7 years ago as a joke. He was fed up with the high cost of regular golf and the exam you have to pass before most Dutch courses even let you on the fairway.
And to pass that exam is, you have to study for half a year and, they make it very complicated. And so I just like to keep it simple.
Boerengolf is certainly simple. 2 teams compete. Each hits a ball towards hole 1. The team that's behind keeps hitting till they're ahead, so the teams stay together. The object? Sink the ball using the fewest strokes. Repeat 10 times with a break in the middle for beer. The end. For boerengolf pioneers, finding space for courses was simple. They were farmers. They had acres of the stuff. And the equipment's simple, too. On Peter's course, the 2 female champs of last year's Dutch Boerengolf Open demonstrate.
A ball?
It sort of looks like a miniature soccer ball, football.
Yeah.
A red one.
And how do I describe this one? Small wooden shoe? On a stock.
A stick.
Yeah. Stick. It looks like a golf club, only the end of the golf club is like a wooden shoe.
It doesn't really look like a golf club.
Yeah, it looks like a golf club.
No, it doesn't. It looks like a wooden shoe on a stick. It also looks like fun.
You can try one shot over there in the grass, and you can feel what it's like.
All right, I'm happy to do so.
Do you play golf?
Wait, can you tell me what we're doing right now?
We're going over the fence.
But it's not just a fence, this is barbed wire.
Yeah.
Well, we have to, because this is the beginning of the hole.
Is this barbed wire electrified?
Yeah, but not very much.
See, the course is the farm. If there's electrified barbed wire, you play through it. If hole four is mined with cow patties, well, you should have worn boots. Speaking of cows, hitting one with a ball will cost you two strokes. So, question, if one blocks your shot, can you shoo it away?
It's allowed, but not when you make kind of movements and a lot of noise. You can always ask a cow to go and step aside.
But you have to ask nicely.
Yes, but it's not only for cows, it's for everybody.
Happy players sip beers at hole five of Peter's course. You'll find similar scenes at 110 farmers' golf courses around Europe. Veining says by next year, more Dutch will play farmers' golf than regular golf. The game that began as a joke is making a serious financial mark.
The big advantage of farmers' golf, you double use your land. You can make a farmers' golf course on the farm, and it can bring you more than your farm brings you.
Veening says that's especially attractive to farmers in the EU, where a quota system requires them to pay a kind of rent if they want to increase production. Farmers' golf gives them another way to grow their business. Cheap. But only if it's not a flash-in-the-pan fad. Peter's solution? Promote the game as a serious international sport. It's easy to imagine Americans warming to this populist pastime, but I'm not sure how long they could live without golf's ultimate money shot.
Have you ever seen a hole-in-one?
No, I have not seen it yet, but it will come. And we say that the first one who makes a hole-in-one gets a tractor.
In Leeuwarden, the Netherlands, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
We've got some pictures of the people and of the cows Rico met during his moving experience. They're on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, when you'll say anything to get a day off from work.
We got 1 week vacation, no sick time, but we did get bereavement time. So I told them my husband's grandmother died, which she did, just like 30, 40 years before that.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, with the financial markets closed, we thought we'd have a real gas with the numbers today. We checked one of the national websites that tracks pump prices, gasbuddy.com. It actually turned up some good news. Just in time for the holiday, the average price for regular gasoline has dropped a few pennies to around $3.19 a gallon today, compared to $3.22 just a week ago. The cheapest gas in the country is still in New Jersey, averaging around $2.94 statewide. The highest statewide average, more than $3.50 a gallon in Hawaii. And a number to keep in mind in your quest for cheap gas, the Petroleum Marketers Association of America points out, if you drive more than 10 miles to save a nickel a gallon, don't bother. The way the math works out, you'll be losing money. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events for Tuesday. The Higher Education Finance Working Group holds a briefing on ways to meet higher education needs in the U.S. Former Vice President Al Gore delivers a talk on his book, The Assault on Reason, to a sold-out crowd at George Washington University. And on this day in 1953, Sir Edmund Hillary and Sherpa Tenzing Norgay reach the summit of Mount Everest. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Maybe you saw this front page story in the Wall Street Journal last week. Headline says, sales of music plunge sharply. Not much of a surprise, but still alarming news for the recording business. The paper reports the music industry has posted some of its weakest sales numbers ever in recent weeks. Sales of compact discs down 20% from a year ago. There's been plenty of finger-pointing, but what if the reason isn't really all that complicated? Reporter Aaron Pressman has a very simple theory that we noticed on his blog over at Business Week magazine's website. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here.
So are you spending the holiday listening to your favorite tunes?
Well, actually, at our house, we've mostly been watching DVDs.
I guess that's the point that you were making in your blog here, that CD sales have been declining for a few years now, but it's not piracy, and it's not the cost of CDs, it's not poor marketing. What do you think it is?
I'm sure all those things had a little bit to do with it, but what's funny to me is that nobody ever steps back to look at the whole picture and say, you know, what are regular people doing with their time? So I started to look into some research about what people are doing with their leisure time.
And what are we doing?
Well, we're watching a lot more television than we used to, and we pay more for it for all kinds of cable and premium channels. You know, HBO is at all-time record subscribership and so forth. We pay more to listen to music on satellite radio. There's 10, 20 million people now who pay to listen to radio. And we watch a lot more video at home. People are buying big televisions. They're buying over a billion DVDs a year now. So there are a lot of other things competing for our attention and our entertainment dollars.
So what got you thinking about this now?
Well, you know, people have been writing about the decline in CD sales for a long time. And this year, it appears to really have accelerated. And this sort of pattern where a slow decline accelerates into a rapid decline is very typical of what happens. You know, the forces start to feed on themselves. Tower Records goes out of business. There are fewer record stores. There's less interest in finding new artists because there's less of a market to put them into. It's the exact same kind of thing you see, you know, for example, at Kodak with film, old analog, old-fashioned film. You know, it went down slowly for a few years, and then finally it just kind of has crashed because all the forces, you know, there's fewer places to buy film and develop it and all that.
DVDs have been around for a while now. Are we seeing a similar trend there?
Well, you know, DVD sales are still rising, although by less and less amounts each year. And this past year, 2006, was the first year ever when the number of new titles released on DVD was not higher than the previous year. So it's the same sort of thing that we saw with music, where the studios have put out their back catalogs. James Bond movies came out for the third time on DVD this year. And eventually that has to end. You know, we'll all have all the old movies and it'll just be the new releases. So you could see the same effect.
Is there a chance that they could learn from the music industry's experience here?
Well, I think in some ways they did learn from the music industry's experience in that DVDs have always been priced very competitively. And CDs were not always priced competitively. In fact, there was even an antitrust action by the Federal Trade Commission in the 90s. So to some degree, I think they did learn about that. But what we're talking about is sort of the inevitable changing tastes of the consumer. And, you know, I guess what they could learn from that is to kind of pay very close attention to what people want and what people are looking for and try and be the next big thing.
Business Week reporter Aaron Pressman, thanks for taking time out of your holiday to speak to us.
My pleasure.
Here's hoping you've been able to enjoy some time to yourself or with those you love on this Memorial Day holiday. And if you found yourself working, well, know that you're not alone. In fact, you can consider yourself lucky if you actually get paid time off. Fewer companies are offering it these days. Here's an encore of a story Marketplace's Amy Scott put together, looking into some of the creative ways people eke out a little extra time off.
Need a day off? Nothing a little cayenne pepper can't fix. There, don't I sound sick? Oh, it hurts. Okay, so maybe there are less painful ways to take a break, but the job site CareerBuilder.com says 43% of the workers it surveyed feigned illness at least once last year in exchange for a day to relax or run errands. Work-life consultant Joe Robinson has a pretty good idea why.
In this country, unlike other industrialized nations, there's no minimum paid leave law, so an employer is not obligated to give anybody any time. So I think in this climate of ever downsizing and leaning and meaning companies, we are seeing vacations being shoved out the door.
But American workers are a resourceful bunch. A survey of the food court at New York's Grand Central Station revealed some interesting tactics. There's the work more, get more time off approach.
I'm a speech therapist. Mostly what I do is just volunteer to work a summer school program. And the more hours I work, the more my vacation time accrues, and then I can take almost a month off at the end of the summer.
Then there's the classic mental health day.
Mental fatigue, I think that qualifies.
Or there's the approach Jennifer tried at a former job. You'll understand why she didn't give her last name in a moment.
We got 1 week vacation, no sick time, and it was an hourly wage job, but we did get bereavement time. So I told them my husband's grandmother died, which she did, just like 30, 40 years before that.
Such unplanned absences cost employers an average $660 per worker per year. That's according to human resources company CCH. Heidi Henson is a workplace analyst with the company. She says employers are battling an entitlement mentality among workers.
Well, in 2005, we found that 14% of employees used unscheduled absences because of this entitlement mentality. Basically, we believe it's years of lean staffing having intensified workloads and employees pushing back and feeling that they deserve more time off.
Trouble is, a stolen day here or there doesn't really work. Even if the guilt doesn't spoil it for you, vacation advocate Joe Robinson says a day off isn't enough to recharge.
Studies show that vacations can cure the last stage of chronic stress, burnout, but it takes 2 weeks for that process to occur.
Of course, most of us have to make that 2 weeks last a whole year. Robinson says there are legitimate ways to get more vacation time. Next time you take a new job, bargain for more paid leave from the get-go. If you have to, ask for a week off unpaid, or just play this for your boss.
The lesson from companies who do offer more vacation time is just incontrovertible. A company in Salem, Oregon, that has 3.5 weeks off for its employees. Since the owner jumped up to this longer vacation schedule, the company has doubled its profits.
I hope my boss is listening. Now, if you do manage to negotiate that extra week off, will you do us all a favor and use it? A study by the travel site Expedia found that as many as 1 in 3 workers won't use all their vacation time this year. Can I have it? In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, alcoholic drinks in the UK will soon carry new warning labels. The government wants to curb an upsurge of binge drinking and alcohol-related deaths. And this is how it's hoping to do it, some helpful numbering on bottles and cans. The labels are supposed to make it easier to compare, as in 1 glass of wine is to 1/2 pint of ale is to 1 shot of whiskey. The idea is providing a clear number of units of alcohol in the bottle or can. There is one problem, though. The idea was introduced today to some booze. That's booing from the booze industry. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. and European markets were closed today for the holiday, but most Asian stocks advanced. The Chinese and South Korean market indexes rose to new records. But oil prices fell to $65 a barrel. Marketplace's producers include Megan Larson, Brett Neely, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, when environmental interests collide.
There are terrific solar resources in the Mojave Desert, but you have to be able to bring the energy into the area where the people live. And that will require either building new transmission or enhancing existing transmission.
I'm Bob Moon. Kai will be back tomorrow. Hope you will be too.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.